Chapter 114. In which a great patriotic conference is holden, the famous name of Myrtle became, every day, more famous in the land. Nobody knew that the Myrtle of such high renown had ever done any good to anyone, alive or dead, or to any earthly thing. Nobody knew that he had any capacity or utterance of any sort in him, which had ever thrown, for any creature, the feeblest farthing candle ray of light on any path of duty or diversion, pain or pleasure, toil or rest, fact or fancy, among the multiplicity of paths in the labyrinth trodden by the sons of Adam. Nobody had the smallest reason for supposing the clay, of which this object of worship was made, to be other than the commonest clay, with as clogged a wick smoldering inside of it as ever kept an image of humanity from tumbling to pieces. All people knew, or thought they knew, that he had made himself immensely rich, and, for that reason alone, prostrated themselves before him, more degradedly and less excusably than the darkest savage creeps out of his hole in the ground to propitiate, in some log or reptile, the deity of his benighted soul. Nay, the high priests of this worship had the man before them as a protest against their meanness. The multitude worshipped on trust, though all was distinctly knowing why, but the officiators at the altar had the man habitually in their view. They sat at his feasts, and he sat at theirs. There was a specter always attendant on him, saying to these high priests, "Are such the signs you trust and love to honor? This head, these eyes, this mode of speech, the tone and manner of this man? You are the levers of the circumlocution office, and the rulers of men. When half a dozen of you fall out by the ears, it seems that Mother Earth can give birth to no other rulers. Does your qualification lie in the superior knowledge of men which accepts, courts, and puffs this man? Or, if you are competent to judge aright the signs I never fail to show you, when he appears among you, is your superior honesty your qualification?" Two rather ugly questions these, always going about town with Mr. Myrtle, and there was a tacit agreement that they must be stifled. In Mrs. Myrtle's absence abroad, Mr. Myrtle still kept the great house open for the passage through it of a stream of visitors. A few of these took affable possession of the establishment. Three or four ladies of distinction and liveliness used to say to one another, "Let us dine at our dear Myrtle's next Thursday. Whom shall we have?" Our dear Myrtle would then receive his instructions, and would sit heavily among the company at table, and wander lumpishly about his drawing rooms afterwards, only remarkable for appearing to have nothing to do with the entertainment beyond being in its way. The chief butler, the avenging spirit of this great man's life, relaxed nothing of his severity. He looked on at these dinners, when the bosom was not there, as he looked on at other dinners, when the bosom was there, and his eye was a basilisk to Mr. Myrtle. He was a hard man, and would never bate an ounce of plate or a bottle of wine. He would not allow a dinner to be given, unless it was up to his mark. He set forth the table for his own dignity. If the guests chose to partake of what was served, he saw no objection, but it was served for the maintenance of his rank. As he stood by the sideboard, he seemed to announce, "I have accepted office, to look at this which is now before me, and to look at nothing less than this." If he missed the presiding bosom, it was as a part of his own state of which he was, from unavoidable circumstances, temporarily deprived. Just as he might have missed a centerpiece, or a choice wine cooler, which had been sent to the bankers. Mr. Myrtle issued invitations for a Barnacle dinner. Lord Decimus was to be there, Mr. Tite Barnacle was to be there, the pleasant young Barnacle was to be there, and the chorus of parliamentary Barnacles who went about the provinces, when the house was up, warbling the praises of their chief, were to be represented there. It was understood to be a great occasion. Mr. Myrtle was going to take up the Barnacles. Some delicate little negotiations had occurred between them, and the noble Decimus, the young barnacle of engaging manners acting as negotiator, and Mr. Myrtle had decided to cast the weight of his great probity and great riches into the barnacle scale. Jobbery was suspected by the malicious, perhaps because it was indisputable that if the adherence of the immortal enemy of mankind could have been secured by a job, the barnacles would have jobbed him for the good of the country, for the good of the country. Mrs. Myrtle had written to this magnificent spouse of hers, whom it was heresy to regard as anything less than all the British merchants since the days of Whittington rolled into one, and gilded 3 feet deep all over, had written to this spouse of hers several letters from Rome, in quick succession, urging upon him with importunity that now or never was the time to provide for Edmund Sparkler. Mrs. Myrtle had shown him that the case of Edmund was urgent, and that infinite advantages might result from his having some good thing directly. In the grammar of Mrs. Myrtle's verbs on this momentous subject, there was only one mood, the imperative, and that mood had only one tense, the present. Mrs. Myrtle's verbs were so pressingly presented to Mr. Myrtle to conjugate, that his sluggish blood and his long coat cuffs became quite agitated. In which state of agitation, Mr. Myrtle, evasively rolling his eyes round the chief butler's shoes without raising them to the index of that stupendous creature's thoughts, had signified to him his intention of giving a special dinner. Not a very large dinner, but a very special dinner. The chief butler had signified, in return, that he had no objection to look on at the most expensive thing in that way that could be done, and the day of the dinner was now come. Mr. Myrtle stood in one of his drawing rooms, with his back to the fire, waiting for the arrival of his important guests. He seldom or never took the liberty of standing with his back to the fire, unless he was quite alone. In the presence of the chief butler, he could not have done such a deed. He would have clasped himself by the wrists in that constabulary manner of his, and have paced up and down the hearthrug, or gone creeping about among the rich objects of furniture, if his oppressive retainer had appeared in the room at that very moment. The sly shadows which seemed to dart out of hiding when the fire rose, and to dart back into it when the fire fell, were sufficient witnesses of his making himself so easy. They were even more than sufficient, if his uncomfortable glances at them might be taken to mean anything. Mr. Myrtle's right hand was filled with the evening paper, and the evening paper was full of Mr. Myrtle. His wonderful enterprise, his wonderful wealth, his wonderful bank, were the fattening food of the evening paper that night. The wonderful bank, of which he was the chief projector, establisher, and manager, was the latest of the many Myrtle wonders. So modest was Mr. Myrtle withal, in the midst of these splendid achievements, that he looked far more like a man in possession of his house under a distrant than a commercial colossus bestriding his own hearthrug, while the little ships were sailing into dinner. Behold the vessels coming into port. The engaging young barnacle was the first arrival, but Barr overtook him on the staircase. Barr, strengthened as usual with his double eyeglass and his little jury droop, was overjoyed to see the engaging young barnacle, and opined that we were going to sit in banco, as we lawyers called it, to take a special argument. Indeed, apostrophe said the sprightly young barnacle, whose name was Ferdinand. How so? Apostrophe, apostrophe, nay, apostrophe, smiled Barr. If you don't know, how can I know? You are in the innermost sanctuary of the temple. I am one of the admiring concourse on the plain without. Apostrophe, Barr could be light in hand, or heavy in hand, according to the customer he had to deal with. With Ferdinand Barnacle he was gossamer. Barr was likewise always modest and self-depreciatory in his way. Barr was a man of great variety, but one leading thread ran through the woof of all his patterns. Every man with whom he had to do was in his eyes a juryman, and he must get that juryman over if he could. Our illustrious host and friend, apostrophe said Barr, our shining mercantile star, going into politics? going? He has been in Parliament some time, you know, returned the engaging young Barnacle. True, said Barr, with his light comedy laugh for special jury men, which was a very different thing from his low comedy laugh for comic tradesmen on common juries. He has been in Parliament for some time. Yet hitherto our star has been a vacillating and wavering star? Humph? An average witness would have been seduced by the humph? Into an affirmative answer, but Ferdinand Barnacle looked knowingly at Barr as he strolled upstairs, and gave him no answer at all. Just so, said Barr, nodding his head, for he was not to be put off in that way, and therefore I spoke of our sitting in Banco, to take a special argument meaning this to be a high and solemn occasion, when, as Captain McKeith says, the judges are met. A terrible show. We lawyers are sufficiently liberal, you see, to quote the captain, though the captain is severe upon us. Nevertheless, I think I could put in evidence an admission of the captain's, said Barr, with a little jocose roll of his head. For, in his legal current of speech, he always assumed the air of rallying himself with the best grace in the world. An admission of the captain's that law, in the gross, is at least intended to be impartial. For what says the captain, if I quote him correctly and if not, with a light comedy touch of his double eyeglass on his companion's shoulder, my learned friend will set me right. Since laws were made for every degree, to curb vice in others as well as in me, I wonder we had better company upon Tyburn Tree. These words brought them to the drawing room, where Mr. Myrtle stood before the fire. So immensely astounded was Mr. Myrtle by the entrance of Barr with such a reference in his mouth, that Barr explained himself to have been quoting Gay. Assuredly not one of our Westminster Hall authorities, said he, but still no despicable one to a man possessing the largely practical Mr. Myrtle's knowledge of the world. Mr. Myrtle looked as if he thought he would say something, but subsequently looked as if he thought he wouldn't. The interval afforded time for Bishop to be announced. Bishop came in with meekness, and yet with a strong and rapid step, as if he wanted to get his 7-league dress shoes on, and go round the world to see that everybody was in a satisfactory state. Bishop had no idea that there was anything significant in the occasion. That was the most remarkable trait in his demeanor. He was crisp, fresh, cheerful, affable, bland, but so surprisingly innocent. Barr sidled up to prefer his politest inquiries in reference to the health of Mrs. Bishop. Mrs. Bishop had been a little unfortunate in the article of taking cold at a confirmation, but otherwise was well. Young Mr. Bishop was also well. He was down, with his young wife and little family, at his cure of souls. The representatives of the Barnacle Chorus dropped in next, and Mr. Myrtle's physician dropped in next. Barr, who had a bit of one eye, and a bit of his double eyeglass for everyone who came in at the door, no matter with whom he was conversing, or what he was talking about, got among them all by some skillful means, without being seen to get at them, and touched each individual gentleman of the jury on his own individual favorite spot. With some of the chorus, he laughed about the sleepy member who had gone out into the lobby the other night, and voted the wrong way. With others, he deplored that innovating spirit in the time which could not even be prevented from taking an unnatural interest in the public service and the public money. With the physician he had a word to say about the general health. He had also a little information to ask him for, concerning a professional man of unquestioned erudition and polished manners, but those credentials in their highest development, he believed, were the possession of other professors of the healing art jury group, whom he had happened to have in the witness box the day before yesterday, and from whom he had elicited in cross-examination that he claimed to be one of the exponents of this new mode of treatment which appeared to Barr to a well, Barr thought so, Barr had thought, and hoped, physician would tell him so. Without presuming to decide where doctors disagreed, it did appear to Barr, viewing it as a question of common sense, and not of so-called legal penetration, that this new system was might be, in the presence of so great an authority, say, humbug? Ah! Fortified by such encouragement, he could venture to say humbug, and now Barr's mind was relieved. Mr. Tite Barnacle, who, like Dr. Johnson's celebrated acquaintance, had only one idea in his head, and that was a wrong one, had appeared by this time. This eminent gentleman and Mr. Myrtle, seated diverse ways, and with ruminating aspects on a yellow ottoman in the light of the fire, holding no verbal communication with each other, bore a strong general resemblance to the two cows in the kite picture over against them. But now, Lord Decimus arrived. The chief butler, who up to this time had limited himself to a branch of his usual function, by looking at the company as they entered, and that, with more of defiance than favor, put himself so far out of his way as to come upstairs with him and announce him. Lord Decimus being an overpowering peer, a bashful young member of the lower house who was the last fish, but one caught by the Barnacles, and who had been invited on this occasion to commemorate his capture, shut his eyes when his lordship came in. Lord Decimus, nevertheless, was glad to see the member. He was also glad to see Mr. Myrtle, glad to see Bishop, glad to see Barr, glad to see Physician, glad to see Tite Barnacle, glad to see Chorus, glad to see Ferdinand his private secretary. Lord Decimus, though one of the greatest of the earth, was not remarkable for ingratiatory manners, and Ferdinand had coached him up to the point of noticing all the fellows he might find there, and saying he was glad to see them. When he had achieved this rush of vivacity and condescension, his lordship composed himself into the picture after Kipe, and made a third cow in the group. Barr, who felt that he had got all the rest of the jury, and must now lay hold of the foreman, soon came sidling up, double eye glass in hand. Barr tendered the weather, as a subject neatly aloof from official reserve, for the foreman's consideration. Barr said that he was told,
as everybody always is told, though who tells them, and why, will ever remain a mystery,
that there was to be no wall fruit this year. Lord Decimus had not heard anything amiss of his peaches, but rather believed, if his people were correct, he was to have no apples. No apples? Barr was lost in astonishment and concern. It would have been all one to him, in reality, if there had not been a pippin on the surface of the earth. But his show of interest in this apple question was positively painful. Now, to what, Lord Decimus, for we troublesome lawyers love to gather information, and could never tell how useful it might prove to us, to what, Lord Decimus, was this to be attributed? Lord Decimus could not undertake to propound any theory about it. This might have stopped another man. But Barr, sticking to him fresh as ever, said, as to pears, now, long after Barr got made Attorney General, this was told of him as a master stroke. Lord Decimus had a reminiscence about a pear tree formerly growing in a garden near the back of his dame's house at Eton, upon which pear tree the only joke of his life perennially bloomed. It was a joke of a compact and portable nature, turning on the difference between Eton pears and parliamentary pears. But it was a joke, a refined relish of which would seem to have appeared to Lord Decimus impossible to be, had without a thorough and intimate acquaintance with the tree. Therefore, the story at first, had no idea of such a tree, sir, then gradually found it in Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.